This is the Education Gadfly Show.
I have been affiliated with this show for some time on and off. Let me just say that your definition of 1 minute has become liberalized over the last couple of years.
Andy, it's the most popular segment, okay?
Now, here's your host, Mike Petrilli.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming my co-host, a man who's getting audited by the IRS as we speak, Andy Smerick.
I just shouldn't have registered as a Republican. I had no idea that that was going to be something I had to worry about.
Well, and I've often seen you blog talking about how you are a patriotic person as well.
Well, that's right.
And with suggestions on how to improve the governance of our country.
Not only that, but I think I've actually used the word Tea Party in something like 2% of my blog posts.
Yep.
So that was a red flag.
And not always in a negative way.
Oh, my God. Oh, no, no. I mean, this is really an unbelievable story. It's getting worse.
Yeah, it is getting worse. And it's as Rick Hess pointed out in his very first ever tweet today. That's right. Rick Hess is on Twitter and he has started to tweet. He pointed out that you can understand why the Tea Party types, libertarians, might have a worry about Common Core and big government when you get news of the IRS going after conservatives, the government wiretapping the Associated Press, the Benghazi talking points, etc., etc.
This is the smoking gun that a lot of the conservatives will point to for quite some time. Oh, you think we're crazy?
Yeah.
Oh, remember when the IRS purposely went after us?
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's it is very true. All right. You're not really having an audit, though, are you?
Not that I know of, but I hate the Tea Party. I'm a Democrat. I'm a loyal progressive. Yeah, I love Obama.
Checker got audited this year. Now he's wondering why might that be? Then again, he supports the Common Core and immigration reform, so be a strange target. Okay, lots to talk about this week beyond what's in the general news. There's a lot of education reform news, too, and Pamela is going to get us started with Pardon the Gadfly.
On Saturday, the UFT hosted a veritable panderpalooza featuring five Democratic candidates for mayor of New York City taking turns praising the union and blasting charter schools in an effort to win the union's support. Does this mean ed reform is toast in the Big Apple?
By the way, we got to give the credit for panderpalooza to one of Bloomberg's spokespeople who used that term on Twitter. And then Bloomberg's chancellor basically said, what was the phrase? He's appalled, I think, by what the candidates were saying the other day. Mm. What's it going on here, Andy? I mean, as I pointed out earlier to some staff, Barack Obama could go before the NEA and talk about merit pay and get booed, still become president. And yet here we have granted the largest city in the country, but still in New York City, these candidates that are just pandering to the unions all over the place. What is happening?
So for people like me who like Saturday Night Live, you know that this is absolutely common. Every 4 years, Saturday Night Live makes fun of the Republican and Democratic primary debates because both of them are the funniest race to the far left, race to the far right. It's just a way that you shore up your base early
on
in the process.
In New York in particular?
No, just this is this goes back to, I think there was an author's last name, Downs or Dawes, that his book was called The Economic Theory of Democracy.
Mm-hmm.
You go to where the votes are.
Right.
And this is a classic case of it. It's a Democratic primary in a big city where some of these where union votes are important and some of these reforms are not all that popular. So what are they going to do? Are they going to say moderate, reform-minded things? No, of course not. I mean, this is just like how Democrats in Democratic primaries just try to prove how liberal they are, how pro-choice they are, or how much they love taxing the rich, or how Republicans hate taxes. This is par for the course.
All right. So does that mean you're skeptical then that these candidates are going to stick to this message if they actually win the primary? A lot of people think that Quinn is going to win, or she's the front runner. If she wins, she's going to come back to the center?
That's exactly what I think. That I think that enough of these reforms are baked in and enough are going to have enough political support among important people that we might see some surface changes, but I don't think reality will match the rhetoric we saw in these debates.
You know, it turns out that Quinn's campaign manager is a former Teach for America teacher.
Really?
Which is interesting. So you would think that maybe the teacher quality kinds of reforms are safe, but boy, I mean, even Quinn has been beating up on charter schools. Poor Eva Moskowitz is just getting clobbered. So I do worry about whether those kinds of reforms, which I would argue have been the most successful reforms in New York City under Bloomberg, whether the charters are going to be okay in the end. We'll find out. Okay, topic number two, Pamela.
Michigan is the latest state to push back against mandatory Algebra 2 for all high school graduates, with a bill gaining steam in the state house that would allow students to take a career and technical education course instead. Is this a good idea?
This actually made me laugh, then shrug and shake my head when I read this question for the first time, because I took a tour of a basis school recently, and I've been reading a lot about basis for a project that I'm doing. And basis, for those who don't know, it's a series of charter schools that are extraordinarily high performing, and their theory of action isn't personalization, it isn't individualization, it is just we need to be double, triple, four times as rigorous in what we teach kids as we have in the past, that this soft bigotry of low expectations just isn't about black, brown, and low-income kids. It's about suburban kids, too. So I walked into a sixth-grade classroom where there were actually some kids doing Algebra 2, sixth graders. Mm-hmm. There were some seventh and eighth graders doing it as well. But it just shows that when you push kids really hard, you can get really great results. I once had a professor in grad school who bemoaned the fact that fewer kids were taking calculus, and the reason why over 20 years, we were teaching calculus less.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I
am against anything that waters down curriculum. It's almost as though we are, this is the reason why A Nation at Risk was written.
All right. Yes, that is true. And in the wake of A Nation at Risk, there were some course requirements that were added for high schools saying, okay, you got to take more math, more reading, more English. The problem was, as we quickly found out, is that if you require high schools to, say, teach more math, they will just relabel their math courses, right? So this requirement that kids take Algebra 2, the high schools respond and say, okay, we'll just split Algebra 1 into two different classes and we'll call the second one Algebra 2.
That's corrupt.
And that happens, right? Now, the answer to that is to say, well, let's have end of course exams that actually measure Algebra 2 content. But then you see what's happening in Texas, where there's a backlash because there's so many end of course exams, 15 end of course exams. Well, you know, you do that over 3 or 4 years. That's, you know, what, 3 or 4 tests a year. That's not so bad, but it still comes off as a lot. So we're stuck with the same problem. Furthermore, Mark Tucker comes out with a report this week saying, actually, you don't need Algebra 2 to be college ready because community colleges are barely teaching any math at all. Basic arithmetic's all you need to be college ready. So it's a mess. Oh, one more point, Andy. Yeah. By the way, the Common Core does have Algebra 2 content in it in high school. So it has determined that you do need the Algebra 2 content to be college and career ready.
All right, let's move on. I'm pro Algebra 2.
You're pro Algebra 2. I think here, look, in my own view, I think trying to mandate courses is a problem. If you're going to do it, you've got to have end of course exams along with it. If you're going to move away from it, again, let's make sure schools are still being accountable towards, say, the Common Core, where at the end of the day, the kids have to hit a certain standard. I don't think Algebra 2 is too much to ask high school students to master.
Not to belabor this basis point, but they believe deeply in AP classes, and they actually make sure how you do on these end of course exams plays into your grades in mm-hmm. your courses. I believe in tough classes, end of course grades being tied to end of course exams.
Mm-hmm. Your kids are going to hate you, Andy.
I am tough when it comes to this stuff. Mm-hmm. Yeah, basis has really made me rethink what we think a good education in suburbia is.
Yeah, let's come back 10 years and see what kind of high school your kids are going to. And
yeah. Probably Montessori High School. Does that exist?
All right, topic number three, Pamela.
Andy, you've launched a weekly interview series on the Fordham blogs called By the Company It Keeps. This week, you interviewed the Common Core Testing Consortia and the U.S. Department of Education. Did this make you more optimistic about the future of the testing consortia?
Yes and no. There are some definitely good things in there and good things about one in particular of the testing consortia, and there are concerns about both of them, and there are some concerns and interesting things raised by the U.S. Department of Education. There are a couple things that I follow this closely that I didn't know that they kind of had in the works, especially regarding checking out on the toughness, the rigor of assessments that are going to be implemented, and I think that is going almost positive. That's going to include include non-consortia tests that states may choose. So if you opt out like Alabama has, if you've made promises to the feds along for stimulus money or race atop or maybe your waiver and you promise to do Common Core and aligned assessments or aligned assessments with high quality standards, it looks like the feds are going to check up on that, according to one of their answers, which is fascinating, something that I had missed somehow.
Well, it's true that under ESEA, the federal government has a responsibility to make sure that the testing systems are peer-reviewed, right? To make sure that they are aligned, the standards and the tests are aligned, and that they meet the requirements of the law. So is that basically what they're talking about here?
Maybe. It seemed a bit tougher than that, mm-hmm. and maybe it's because all of these tests are going to be brand new and aligned with brand new standards. Mm-hmm. But I read it and first thought, wow, that's tough. But then I thought, is the federal government actually going to tell a state that has gone through multiple years of trying to build tests and get ready for these new standards that mm-hmm. we're going to withhold money because we don't like your tests?
Right.
It'll probably end up more as a negotiated agreement like they did with the waivers and some other things.
There is precedent here. I mean, back in the No Child Left Behind days, they took money away from Georgia, I believe it was, because it just used an off-the-shelf test and that was clearly not aligned to its standards 1 year instead of an aligned test. And so it got dinged for that. So I think
that
what they have to go on here is alignment. And of course, I'm sure that our friends on the right are going to be watching this carefully. If it feels like the federal government is micromanaging these tests, that is going to create some concerns as well.
So I am a complete believer, and anyone who read these interviews know that I actually am of the mind that high-quality aligned exams are, if not the cornerstone, one of the big load-bearing walls of a standards accountability curriculum system. And I, for people who are concerned, who want Common Core to succeed, you should be watching the possible splintering of these consortia very, very closely. It is an open question how many states are going to stick in, and those that leave, whether they're going to pick tests that really are rigorous, really are aligned, mm-hmm. and where they set their cut scores. This 2 years ago, I bet a lot of Common Core advocates thought that this was a fait accompli.
Nobody thought that, Andy.
No,
everybody knew that we were going to lose a bunch of these states. I mean, everybody said, look, we got 45 states. There's no way we're going to get across the finish line.
No, people talked a lot about the standards themselves, but whether or not states were going to stick with these assessments, what the assessments look like, and the idea that the market may create tests that may ultimately outpace the ones mm-hmm. that the federal government spent $350 million on. No, 330, I think. That's actually a really interesting point. Mm-hmm. The feds tried to prop up a market, and the market actually responded, mm-hmm. and there may be more demand for their tests. Whether their tests are as good is an open question.
Park and Smarter Balanced both told you, Andy, that they will deliver their tests on time, computer-based, with paper and pencil alternatives for schools that aren't ready for the computers.
Exactly.
And they are sticking by those promises.
And even Smarter Balanced said that they have no reason to believe that there will be any fewer of their members than the 21 governing they have today. Underline that, and let's keep an eye.
Okay, great. Thanks so much, Andy. Good work on the blog, on the interviews, and
thank
of course
you.
On Part of the Gadfly. Thank you, Pamela. Now it's time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mike.
So you liked Andy's little yay there?
I did. I liked the yay. I was feeling the love. Of course, now he's got his phone out. He's going to time me, so that love disappeared quickly.
Liz, I have been affiliated with this show for some time on and off, and let me just say that your definition of 1 minute has become liberalized over the last couple of years.
Andy, it's the most popular segment, okay? What are we going to do? We give the people what they want, okay?
I mean, 90 seconds? Are people really, like, squabbling over, like, 30 extra seconds?
I think they would rather Mike and I talk about Park and Smarter Balanced.
I think if it's a minute, 25 seconds, you round down, and
it's
okay.
All right, bring it on.
All right, Amber.
And I just might, like, stop in the halfway through.
The great thing about Amber is even though she's from the South and she has that great Southern accent, she still can talk quite fast.
Fast. I do.
Let's talk fast. Let's prove it. TikTok.
This week, we have a new study out by Susanna Loeb and colleagues called Systematic Sorting. It examines the extent to which teacher sorting occurs within schools not just across schools. Okay, it does not look at the effectiveness of those teachers. Okay, that's a big important point. Analysts compare class assignments of teachers who teach in the same grade and in the same school in a given year. They use administrative data for staff, students in schools in Miami-Dade Public Schools. That's the fourth largest school district in the country from 2004 to 2011, the years they looked at. Top three findings. First, less experienced minority and female teachers are assigned to classes with lower achieving students than are their more experienced white or male colleagues. Second, teachers who have held leadership positions and those who attended more competitive undergraduate colleges are also assigned higher achieving students. Third, black teachers generally had the most challenging assignments, especially when they taught in schools with more white colleagues. Whether any of these findings is nefarious is unclear. Analysts find, for instance, that the gender gap is largely explained by the propensity of female teachers to teach in special education. And those teachers typically have lower test scores. I think they should have taken those kids out. Yep. Right. Students. The racial differences are explained in part by the tendency of black and Hispanic teachers to be assigned more minority and poor students. But analysts hypothesize that some minority teachers want to work with minority or low-achieving students, while others are probably assigned to them, possibly on the belief that they can establish better relationships with those students. And if minority students learn more from minority teachers, this could be a good thing. Finally, if teachers from selective colleges have higher test scores, which they obviously do, and they end up with advanced classes, then assigning them to higher achieving kids may be beneficial for those kids. So in the end, patterns of teacher assignment are complex, resulting from teacher, parent, student, and principal preferences. It could be good or bad, depending on how you look at it. Boom, how long?
I love Amber's research. 2 minutes.
Oh, man. Was it really?
Oh, my gosh. If I doubled my...
1 minute, wow. 58 seconds.
Wow. It didn't seem that long to
Thank
me.
Thank you, Mike.
Well, I'm just saying, because I've been doing it every week now for, you know, 6 years. It doesn't seem so long.
Oh, my gosh. I've doubled. All right. I'll try it better next week. But look, there were, that was just three findings, and it was really long.
And it was interesting. I was riveted the whole time, Andy.
It was riveted.
What did you want
riveted?
To cut out?
You were too busy, like, timing me to be riveted, weren't you?
See, this is exactly why you need outside observers to come in and norm. I mean, I don't know, groupthink has set in here. No, it was riveting. And
all right.
But my first impression from this is a great example of quantitative research that should be released with qualitative research to back it up, because this is incendiary. Mm-hmm. People could read this and make all types of assumptions about, like you said, nefarious motives, when it might not be that. It could be,
right.
But I would have loved to have some researchers go in there, ask some questions, figure out what was actually going on, because if we just make a bunch of assumptions, this is sad.
Mm-hmm. Well, is it sad? I mean, what we don't know is whether or not these different categories that we think relate to effectiveness really do relate to effectiveness, right? I mean, it's surprising in this day and age that there's a teacher study that did not use value added, right?
Yeah. Right.
So we don't know, for example, whether the lowest achieving kids were put with the least effective teachers. Maybe. I mean, certainly we would expect that the teachers with the higher scores might get higher value added, but we don't know
that
for sure.
So what they do say is that this could impact value-added scores and data, because we are, if this is right, then we actually have some things we're not controlling for in those value-added estimates, which could obviously bias them. So,
yep. Anyway. And look, Andy, I mean, here's, you know, there is some good research that says that all else equal, African American kids will learn more if taught by an African American teacher.
Is that true?
It is true that there is such research. Look at Education Next. And, you know, it's what Tom D,
Tom D, I think it was.
I need to take another look at that, because I thought the research on that was equivocal at best. I thought the body of it was.
Well, Tom D's study wasn't just a year ago. It was fairly recent.
It was pretty good. So, I mean, so there, and now again, that doesn't mean we should necessarily then say, well, let's then group all the African American kids together and give them a black teacher. I mean, there's a lot of good reasons not to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But there's an argument that it actually could help. Let's just remember that this does not look at teacher effectiveness. I hope that maybe the next thing they do is to see how these patterns play out when it comes to effectiveness.
But one thing we can say is this could have a teacher turnover impact, right? If your less experienced teachers are chronically getting the kids who are harder to educate, they are not going to stick around, presumably.
Now, this is where the guy who's worked in a bunch of government agencies in me comes out. Often these institutions are so dysfunctional, or they have motives that are just hard to comprehend for people on the outside, that I wouldn't presume anything about Let me just say it this way. TNTP, one of their very first reports, came out and showed that the reason why urban school districts often don't get really high-quality teachers isn't because high-quality teachers don't want to go there. It's because urban districts can't get their acts together and make offers to teachers so late in the school year. So we could have assumed that there was this human capital effect for these other types of reasons, when in fact it was the dysfunction of the district that led to that. So again, I would just want to do a case study of some of these schools, some of these districts, and find out what's actually happening before we assume anything.
All right.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, we don't know. And there's also like parents, right? I mean, Mike, I'm sure when your kids get older, you're going to find out who their teacher is. And if you don't like her, then hey, why can't my kid have this teacher? So, I mean, that's the other stuff that we can't measure in studies like this that's important. I know my mom, fourth grade, my mom was calling up the school. She wanted me to have Ms. Shedler. And guess what? I got Ms. Shedler.
I am ready to tweet Joshua Starr and at a moment's notice. All right. The superintendent of Montgomery County. Yes, we are Twitter pals. So, you know, and I've been on his podcast, right, which, by the way, is a pretty good podcast, but nothing like the Education Gadfly Show.
That's right.
Speaking of which, we are out of time today for the show.
It's because of my 2 minutes that I took.
Yes, Amber, work on that, would you? Work on it. 1 minute next time.
Yes.
Till next time.
I'm Andy Smerick.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute's Education Gadfly Show, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.